This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The new film Beautiful Boy stars Steve Carell as a father struggling with his son's drug addiction. Today we're listening to Terry's interviews with the real people the story is based on. Earlier we heard journalist David Sheff and his son Nick, who both wrote memoirs about the family's experience with Nick's addiction. 5 years after that interview, David Sheff returned to Fresh Air. They talked about his book, Clean, which focuses on medical and scientific research into addiction and recovery.
David Sheff, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Terry, thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you back. Addiction as a brain disease is one of the main points of your book, but what do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, Nick became a different person. The only explanation I ultimately came to is that he was ill. At first, I didn't believe that. I thought, you know, he was just this selfish, crazy teenager. But then the more I learned, I mean, 10 kids would go out after, you know, school, and they'll all smoke pot, or at a party on the Friday night, they'll all drink. And one of those, possibly two of those, will become addicted. So there's something different about that person. There's something different about the brain. And I've seen brain scans. There's so much research now that shows that people with addiction process drugs differently. Their neurological system is different. A different part of the brain is in control. You know, we think about addiction as a morally reprehensible choice, but addicts act crazy because in a way that they are.
So, you know, you write in the book that going through detox is just the first step. You know, after you've given up the drug and you've come out the other end, you still need treatment. And maybe not just, you know, a 12-step kind of program. Maybe you really need psychiatric treatment and medication to help you through whatever the problem was that helped lead to your addiction in the first place.
There was this really dangerous idea for so long that all someone had to do was get off drugs. They had to detox. You know, they had to go through cold turkey, and they would wake up in the morning and they'd be sober. Being sober is just the first step. Getting off drugs is just the first step, and then treatment really begins. If someone has psychological disorders, most often they haven't been diagnosed. Whether they have or haven't, they need to be treated. If someone is struggling in some other ways in their life, they need help.
You write that young people are more susceptible to addiction, and addiction is especially dangerous for young people, and this all has to do with the development of their brain. The part of the brain known as the prefrontal cortex is still developing when you're young. Talk about the importance of that part of the brain in a young person's development and then in addiction.
Well, kids are the most vulnerable to becoming addicted. You know, it's a really stressful time in their lives. I mean, being an adolescent is really hard. But there also is this underlying, teenagers' brains are developing more rapidly than at any other time in their life. But all the parts of the brain don't develop at the same time. The frontal part of the brain, which is associated with judgment and rational thinking, is lagging. So it's not in control. And meanwhile, the first parts of the brain to develop is the rear portion, which is associated with pleasure seeking and impulsiveness. So it's in control. We always think about teenagers being impulsive, you know, they want to experiment, they have, you know, all kinds of crazy, reckless behavior. A lot of it is because of that. Their brain hasn't developed to the point where they can moderate these impulses. So it's much more likely that kids are going to use drugs, and they're more likely to use them excessively. So the development is even slower. The part of the brain that normally would regulate, would help kids make better decisions, isn't in control. So they start using more, and there's this cycle. And that's where addiction comes from. 90% of the people who become addicted started using when they were teenagers, before they were 18.
A lot of memoirs written by people who had been addicts start with them hitting bottom. You know, the absolutely worst imaginable thing that happened to them because of their addiction. And then they hit bottom, and then they go into rehab, and they seek treatment, and then things start to turn around, and then the book kind of begins. And so many stories, just like addict stories that are, you know, are told, you know, start again with like hitting bottom. And I think a lot of people assume that if you love somebody who is addicted to a substance, that until they hit bottom and until they really realize that their life is at stake, that their dignity is at stake, that there's no way they're going to give up, you know, the drug or the alcohol. And you make the point in the book that that's not necessarily true, that if you love somebody who's an addict, you don't need to wait till they hit bottom. You can intervene and perhaps intervene effectively.
If you love someone who's an addict and their use is life-threatening, you don't wait until they hit bottom, because that can mean that they're going to die. You have to do everything you can to get them in treatment. And now we know that it's too dangerous to wait for a person to hit bottom. I mean, people were told that they had to let their kids, you know, their husbands, their wives, whoever it was, they had to stand back, not to intervene, let them hit bottom so they would crawl into a treatment center and say, please help me. That idea, it's so dangerous. It has killed so many people. The other problem with it is that this is a progressive disease, which means that as long as it's not being treated, it gets worse. Addiction is a disease like anything else. It's like cancer, like heart disease, like diabetes. And we know, you know, at the first signs of serious illness, we want to seek treatment. If someone in our families had early warning signs of any of those diseases, we would bring them to a doctor to figure out what is going on. We would not wait until the disease progressed. So we want to intervene the second we get a sense that there is a problem.
But, you know, with addiction, and this is different from cancer, a person has to be willing to change, to stop using. And, I mean, you can lock them up in an environment where they can't get drugs, whether that's prison or, mm-hmm. or, you know, put them in rehab where there's not going to be any drugs. But when they get out, you know, unless there's constant surveillance, they still have to make that decision to not use. Let me give you an example of a story that you've told about your son when he was addicted, that he would call you, you know, from the street and say, you have to pick me up. I think I'm dying. You have to come get me and take me home. And you didn't want to do that because you'd been burned before. You'd take him home and he would steal from you. He would do things that would be dangerous for your younger children to observe. So you finally said to him, no, I'll pick you up and I'll take you to rehab. And your son said, no, I don't want to go to rehab. It doesn't work for me. You need to take me home. And you said, call back when you're ready to go to rehab, and you hung up. So if you had to do that over again, would you think that that was the right way of handling it?
No. I tried, though, so many times to get him into treatment, and I would do anything it took. I would drag him off the streets. I searched for him when I could find him. You know, I just did whatever it took to get him into treatment, and it hadn't worked. Every time he would go into treatment, he would do fine for a while, and then he would relapse. So my assumption was that relapse proved that the treatment hadn't worked. What I now know is that many times, not always, but many times, relapse is a part of this disease. So addicts get sober. It's a chronic illness. The craving doesn't go away unless it's being treated, and relapse is common. That means that even though Nick was resistant to going back into treatment, every time I had to do whatever I could to get him into treatment. And when Nick called up begging me to go back, telling me that he was going to die, so many times I had succumbed. I mean, all I wanted to do was, never mind to get him help, but I just wanted to see him, to see that he was alive. But I finally listened to the messages of these rehab programs that talk about this tough love thing and that he had to hit bottom. And I hung up the phone and I wept. It was the hardest thing I'd ever done. And he did call, you know, just a few days later and said he was ready to go into treatment, but he absolutely could have died.
In that story, you basically had two options that I can think of. One is to say, well, if I'm not driving you to rehab, I'm not picking you up at all. And the other is, okay, I'll take you home. You chose the, if I'm not driving you to rehab, I'm not taking you home at all. And you think you're lucky that he didn't die as a result and that he chose to go to rehab a few days later. So in retrospect, do you think you should have chosen the other option, would have been, I'll take you home? And maybe he wouldn't have gone to rehab.
I think that every situation is different. And in retrospect, it was fine. In retrospect, you know, It worked. But if I was there again, I would have gone to get him and brought him home and done everything I could to get him into treatment, because every day he was out there, it was so dangerous. I mean, that night, I didn't sleep, of course. I was just petrified, and I had a reason to, because he could have gone out and scored and overdosed and died. If I'd got him home, at least he would have been off the streets, and I may have been able to get him back in treatment, and I would have done everything I could to get him back. The way I feel now, yeah, you want to get your kid off the streets. It's too dangerous out there.
If your child's under 18, you can force them to go into rehab, right?
In most places, you can. Yes, you can. It's not easy. In some states, it's really complicated. You have to get judges' orders. You have to essentially commit them. A police officer maybe has to come and pronounce them a threat to themselves or someone else. But still, parents do have the legal right to get their kids into treatment.
Did you ever do that?
I never had to resort to any kind of legal means of getting Nick into treatment, but still, I had a lot of leverage. You know, he was living at home. He would be desperate. He would want to come home. He would want help. So he would call me up, and he would be willing to go to treatment. So I had some leverage. I never had to do a formal intervention, but people do them. They're dangerous. One of the pieces of advice I got over and over again from professionals is that they must be done by professionals, by people who are trained to do interventions. They know what's going on, and they understand the risks. But I never had to do that. I was able to get Nick into treatment other ways. But whatever it takes to get someone to treatment, that's what we got to do.
What were the other ways?
Well, sometimes Nick would just get tired of being out there, and he would be so desperate. He would, you know, he just wanted to get off the streets. You know, it wasn't necessarily even life-threatening. And so he was willing to go into treatment because that was my deal. I'll come pick you up, you know, drive you to a treatment center, check you in. And so he would do it. But as things went forward, I mean, the last time Nick relapsed, you know, he'd been sober for a long time. It was after Nick and I talked to you on your show. And, you know, one day we were together and he said, "I cannot believe what I did. I was at someone's house, just almost automatic. I opened up the medicine cabinet. There was a bottle of Vicodin. I took one. I thought to myself, just one," which is common for addicts to, you know, that's the first thing that they'll say to themselves and to us. And soon the bottle was gone. And he said, "I woke up this morning and realized that if I don't do something, I am going to be back on the streets within a week." So he, you know, this was the first time I didn't have to say a word. He got on the phone. He called the Hazelden Treatment Center in Minnesota. He was on a plane that day. To me, it's possible to look back on that and say, you know, all the treatments before that were a failure. Here he was, sober for such a long time, and he relapsed again. But to me, it's the opposite. It shows that the treatments had helped him so much that he was able to recognize that he was in a free fall, that it was so dangerous for him. He had learned what they teach in a lot of treatment centers, this behavioral cognitive thing where you can interrupt either the craving that would lead to relapse or you can stop a relapse early. And if you can, you know, you've made so much progress. One of the things they talk about with addiction is progress, not perfection. So, you know, when Nick got in that plane that day, I saw great, great progress. And since then, he's been sober. So, you know, it shows that it's possible. I mean, people think that treatment can't work. Nick's proof that it does.
So let's talk a little bit about 12-step treatment programs. You have a lot of experience with them because I think Nick had been in a 12-step program. You've probably gone to, you know, a 12-step program for parents.
Al-Anon, yeah.
Yeah. And then you visited them just as research for the book. So you see, you know, positives and negatives with the 12-step program. So I think most people know what the positive parts are, but what are some of the problems you have with 12-step?
The 12 steps are completely a profound, you know, treatment for so many people, but not most people. And that's the problem that I have. It's not with the 12 steps. It's only many, many rehabs are based on this idea that the 12 steps are the key, are the only way to stay sober. That's my problem. So my problem with the 12 steps is only when it's forced. And it is forced in many places. Nick was kicked out of some treatment programs because he wouldn't embrace the 12 steps. And so we have to understand that, you know, there are many ways to get sober. And the 12 steps is one, and it works for some people, but there need to be alternatives. But I did go to Al-Anon meetings, and what I found there was something different that helped me. You know, when Nick became addicted, I didn't know other families who had kids who were addicts. I was ashamed, and I felt that I was the only one. And people told me over and over and over again, go to Al-Anon meetings, go to Al-Anon meetings. I would sort of roll my eyes and think, I am not going into one of those rooms where people are, you know, whining and sitting around in a circle. And I walked into one of those rooms finally, and I felt, you know, these were my people. They know what I'm going through because they're going through it too. So that comfort and that support was profound for me. Also, going into these rooms, you know, I was suffering so much inside, and so I would go through my day, and I would have to, you know, put on this face that everything was okay, and I had to work. I'd go to my younger children, Daisy and Jasper's school, and you know, I had to keep it together. I walked into these rooms, and I didn't have to keep it together. I was allowed to just sit in the back and feel, you know, whatever it was, this just terror, and other people were feeling it, and I was able to cry, and I was able to... You know, there was no pretense in those rooms. There was this openness. It didn't make things go away, but it made it easier to get through some of the days.
Let's end on a positive note. And if it's okay, if it's not prying into your son Nick's privacy, he sounds like he's doing really well now professionally as well as personally. Just give us a little update on his life if that's not prying too much.
It's not. I mean, Nick is really, you know, I think he's great. I mean, what could I say? He's an unbelievable person. I mean, yeah, I'm his dad, and so I'm prejudiced, but he's extraordinary. He's just this lovely person. He helps a lot of people get and stay sober. I hear from people all the time, you know, with kids who say, I read Nick's book, I heard him talk, and that's why I've gone into recovery. He's really healthy. He exercises every day. He got married to this woman that we adore. You know, they were best friends when they were sixth and seventh grade. He's writing like mad. He just had a novel accepted. So, you know, we're just so lucky. We're just so lucky. I mean, all these other things are great, but the main thing is that he's alive. There were so many times when I didn't think he was going to make it.
David Scheff, thank you so much for talking with us. And please send my best regards to your son, Nick. I spoke with him once on the show, and I'm so glad he's doing well. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Terry, thank you so much.
David Scheff speaking with Terry Gross in 2013. The new film Beautiful Boy is based on two memoirs, one written by David Scheff and the other by his son Nick Scheff, about Nick's addiction to meth and Nick's subsequent recovery. We're happy to update that Nick is drug-free today. He's married and has written two novels and scripts for two television shows. He and his father attended the premiere of Beautiful Boy in Los Angeles last week.